Hello and welcome to this Transforming Business Minds podcast. I'm Alan Patching. Today I'm pleased and privileged to be interviewing a very interesting gentleman. His name is John Thomas, and he's had some extremely interesting roles throughout his career. He was trained as a biochemist originally, but went on to be very, very prevalent in the world of economics. In fact, he was a columnist for The Economist in Tokyo, worked in England, in the Middle East, and generally has a very good grip on the economy indeed. In fact, right now, he's affectionately known as the Mad Hedge Fund Trader, but mad is not a description that most people would use for John. Amongst other things, he's an advisor on economics to President Obama of the United States of America, and he's an advisor to officials of many, many governments around the world. John knows the economy on a world level. He gets information from the normal sources and from an incredibly wide range of contacts that most of us would never have a hope of talking to and getting their ideas on world affairs from. So John is here to give us his insights based on this amazing life experience and the incredible contact base of high-level people that he deals with on a day-by-day basis in the world. John, welcome.
Morning, how are you?
I'm very well indeed, and thank you for joining us. And in this 15 or 20 minutes, we just want to give the listeners some insight in what's happening in the economy, in particular for the Australian market, but more broad. So let's just start with the broader analysis. What do we face with in the immediate future?
Well, the big surprise here, which is being wildly underestimated by most commentators, is that things are getting better a lot faster than people realize. That we're in a global synchronized economic recovery for the first time in 7 years. The economies of the United States, Japan, China, and Europe are all improving at the same time. And this is having massive impacts on financial markets.
When you mention those bigger parts of the world, you can see that in certain of the trends. Others have different opinions, I know that, but let's stay with yours at the moment. A lot of our listeners are from the Middle East as well. What's the import in terms of global position for them at the moment, particularly in respect of, say, oil prices and the economies there?
Well, I think that the risk of oil shocks or sudden price appreciation of oil that we saw a few years ago to 150, those are in the past. The U.S. is becoming a large net energy exporter. This also will surprise people in the speed at which this unfolds. And the Middle East is going to have to come up with a new game. Fortunately, China is around. China has insatiable energy needs. And I am seeing a major realignment of political relationships with the Middle East, moving from the United States as a principal ally to China as a principal ally. That will be one of the major geopolitical developments of this century.
And when you look at the impact of that, given that a lot of the currencies in the Middle East are tied to the US dollar, is there an impact from the value of the dollar? Do you see people breaking from the dollar as that link with other countries takes precedence?
Well, because of their massive investments in the United States, it is in the Middle Eastern interest right now for, to have a strong dollar and a healthy US economy.
And therefore to be tied to it.
And therefore to keep the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency from their own point of view, keep their assets in dollars. That's going to be a winning strategy over the long term. That said, as an increasing part of your trade becomes with China, you can expect the yuan to enter the equation in a pretty substantial way going forward, especially as the Chinese economy strengthens over time. So they could move to some sort of dual currency reserve structure in the Middle East where some of their assets, their investment assets are in U.S. dollars, but their trade is in Chinese yuan, and therefore they need to keep a portion of their assets in yuan to finance that trade.
Okay. Bringing this back to the Southwest Pacific region again, the Australian dollar. Last time we spoke was a couple of years ago, and you rightly predicted a downfall in the Australian dollar, and a lot of the people who took your advice did very well out of that, including myself. Going forward, do you have a different view? Is the dollar going to continue to go down? What's going to happen there?
Well, over the long term, if you have a strong U.S. dollar, you should have a stronger Australian dollar, and going out 10, 20 years, it's not impossible to see two U.S. dollars to the Australian dollar or the currency doubling from current levels. And this isn't really an outrageous forecast because the currency's doubled in just the last 6 or 7 years. So all I'm predicting is a continuation of that trend. Anything that's positive for a world economy is positive for Australia more so, because it means it gets higher prices for its commodities and all of its exports.
When you say it's doubled, that's in economic language, but for most people, if they look back 6 and 7 years, the fluctuations probably, or even 10 years, fluctuations probably between 75 and a dollar 10. Are you talking about the relative value of currencies one for the other?
Well, I know it hit 58 cents because I bought it at 58 cents. That was, you know, buying at 58 cents, one of the world's largest producers of iron ore, coal, gold, and food, that was a no-brainer for me. That did happen.
It's interesting, you know, there's a prediction that was released by one of the bank economists, I think it was in the last quarter, that said by the end of 2014, the New Zealand dollar, for the first time in 40 or 50 years, mm-hmm. will be stronger than the Australian.
Yeah.
Can you see that temporarily happen? It's said to happen
off the
back of
the bank. It may not be temporary. It may be permanent, because New Zealand is more oriented towards a food economy than Australia is. And because of various scandals in China involving adulteration of baby milk and stuff like that, milk powder, prices for New Zealand products have gone through the roof. I think if you have to pick one commodity that's going to outperform all the others on a 20, 30-year view, it's food. Because there just is no substitute for food. You know, China's got to feed 1.2 billion people, and there's nothing to do that but food. So if you have a higher percentage of your economy producing food, you're going to be a greater beneficiary of that rising price of food. And this current scandal-driven rise in prices could be just the opening shot in a very long-term secular rise in food costs. You know, the world is making people faster than the food to feed them. It's adding 2 billion people to the population in the next 40 years. Half of that growth will be in countries that can't feed themselves today, like in Egypt, like in Algeria, the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and so on.
So do you see that as a crisis effect, or do you see that as an economic boon effect, or both?
It's both. I'm very close to the U.S. military. I have, you know, a great number of contacts there, and I can tell you all of their war planning on far-out years is all about food.
As opposed to oil.
Oil, yeah. You know, the wars of the last 50 years have really been all about oil. For the next 50, they're going to be about food.
You hear also that the wars in the future will be about water. Do you include water in the food or not?
Yes, and it just turns out that the U.S. also is very well positioned in water with the Great Lakes and large freshwater supplies. Number two is Siberia, Russia.
Yeah.
And I see a massive international trade developing as Siberia ships its water south to China and also India.
I'm going to throw you a question that might be a little bit difficult, and if it is, I'm happy for you not to answer it, given your business contacts, etc. But it seems that if this far in advance, the generals of the U.S., high-level people, understand that the next wars will be about food, and given the innovative power of the U.S., that would be something that would allow them to prevent a future war about food. Or do you think there really is this sinister conspiracy theory that people think that if they know it's about food, then let's create a war about food so that the businesses benefit? What's your
view on that? Say it was much easier to create a war about oil than it was about food, because the food markets are far more fragmented than the energy markets ever were. You have 100 plus producing countries all over the world, 100 plus major traded products. So it really is too broad of a market for any single entity to try and control. And you know, I can tell you that the U.S. military is far more interested in preventing wars than starting them.
They're given the cost.
They know what they cost.
Exactly.
Both in terms of dollars and men.
And that money's got to go to an aging population and their medical care.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look forward now. We've looked at the macro circumstance. Let's turn the discussion to the micro situation.
Mm-hmm.
From a microeconomic perspective, how does all this translate to someone in Australia or the Middle East, where our two listener bases are for this, to someone who's running a business? They have to make some strategy about their business, what they should be involved with, should they be investing in their own business, should they be putting a percentage of their profit or capital into the share market. How does it translate into a detailed strategy, to the extent you can answer that without looking at a particular business?
Well, Australians are actually in a great position vis-a-vis the rest of the world because they are well-educated, they speak English or something roughly akin to English, and they are technologically savvy, which means they are in the front line of participating in a global economy and benefiting from it. You know, the trade alert service I offer is already used by hundreds of people in Australia, and I'm getting emails about people reporting fabulous performances in the international markets just with a little bit more information than they're getting now, which my service provides. So I'm very bullish on Australia longer term. I would much rather be an Australian than most of the other nationalities of the world right now.
Going again to the micro side of it, some speakers at the conference we're at are saying that the best thing you can do at the moment is sell your real estate and be liquid or buying and working the market. Do you contribute to that theory?
No, I don't buy that at all. You know, of course, prices have gone up a lot in Australia, and they're high compared to traditional benchmarks. Right now, a house in Australia sells for 7 times annual earnings compared to 3 times in the U.S., On the other hand, as long as your marginal net buyer is coming from China and they're paying cash, they're not borrowing to buy these properties, that the benchmark for prices isn't historic Australian prices, it's historic Chinese prices. And I can tell you that prices in Hong Kong, Shenzhen, Shanghai, Beijing are much, much higher than they are here. So you know, if you look at what $500,000 gets you here as opposed to China, you'd be staggered at the difference. You get a shoebox for $500,000 in China compared to what you get here. So you think it's expensive, the Chinese think it's cheap. And as long as they're the big buyers and they have the cash, their opinion is more important than yours.
There's been a lot of debate about that very point in the press here recently, in that Chinese buyers coming out, typically buying in a city around where all the traditional university grounds are and all that, pushing the leases up, and the people with the lease money are being affected, and whether or not that's fair. Should the government be looking at that and saying we need to step in and control that, or is that just today's, it's a world economy, face it?
Yeah, it's really tough to stand in the way of a capital flow, because if you do set up barriers, they always seem to find ways around it. In a capitalist system, you have to let money flow like water, you know, go to its greatest return. It will always do that. That is the great benefit of the system. You know, that said, in the example you cited, universities, housing costs for students and so on, there's always room for subsidies, for grants, and so on, to enable students to attend university and still have a place to live. This is the role of government to step in and fix those flaws that need addressing, and that's a perfect example of one.
Or as a friend of mine says, let them live out a little bit further and discover the discomfort of coming in by train like we had to when we were younger. In Australia, and this again may be a little different, but a policy thing from your perspective, Qantas has been declaring itself in a little bit of trouble. Now, Qantas is both two things. It's the national airline, and it's an Australian icon. The claim by the CEO is that, of course, they're competing with not fair partners. One might argue that maybe the other partners put on a better service. I personally find Qantas service in the air great. But there's no question that the other airlines put on a great all-around service as well. The question is, particularly given that Qantas started as a government-funded airline and existed like that for ages itself, it's almost a bit hypocritical, I guess, in a historical viewpoint, but should government step in and protect the industries that are iconic as opposed to, say, some of the car industries? Some in Australia would argue that Holden cars are part of our national heritage,
almost as much as the Anzac tradition.
Yeah, slavery was part of your national heritage, too, and that's not around anymore. Locking up prisoners in ships and sending them to Australia is part of your national heritage, and that's kind of gone by the wayside.
Part of the British one, actually.
Right. That is always the classic explanation for preventing progress, for stopping the evolution of the global economy. I've never been a big fan of government support or rescue of dying industries. I am a supporter of government support and encouragement of new industries, especially when they can speed the process along, like the U.S. government is doing now with the alternative energy business in the U.S. As far as Qantas goes, 40 years ago when I was a young, wet-behind-the-ears trader and didn't know anything, one of the senior traders took me aside and he said, don't ever trade the airlines. They're totally dependent on the cost of fuel, the interest rates, and the state of the economy, and management never, ever knows what any of those three are going to do. It's a total crapshoot. So stay away. Turned out to be, this was like in 1980, just as the U.S. airline industry was regulated, every airline that existed then has since gone bankrupt.
It turns out to be a prophetic
statement.
Turned out
to be fantastic advice. That's true for Qantas, too.
Yeah.
If they can't compete on price, why should they have an advantage, over other airlines? And, in fact, most national flag carriers have gone out of business. Hmm. Swiss Air went out of business. Air France is hanging on by its fingernails and only exists with government help. All the old American flag carriers, Pan Am, TWA, they're all gone. Why should Qantas be any different?
So it's all about having airline services, but there's no necessity really for a national airline service.
Yeah, so. 50 years ago, an airline used to be sort of like a diplomat, it represented your country. That's just not true anymore. I'd much rather have Apple representing my country than Pan Am, or Microsoft instead of TWA.
Anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. You like Qantas, buy the T-shirt. what else can I say?
No, I think you said it pretty well. Let's just have a couple of wrap-up questions and then look at things going forward. Someone sitting down looking at their business out, say, 3 to 5 years, or maybe their personal investment. Should they be investing in their own business? Should they be investing in stocks, holding in cash, gold? What would be, not in percentage terms, but the sort of things they ought to be thinking about?
That is a really easy question to answer. Invest in yourself. The more you invest in yourself, the more you'll get out of life, the more you'll get out of your business. You are your own greatest asset. The more you invest in yourself, the greater your returns over life will be. And by the way, the younger you are, the more you invest in yourself, the greater the returns over time will be. That is one of the goals of my newsletter, to allow you, to enable you to invest in yourself, make you a smarter person, a better trader, more knowledgeable about the global economy. You can do all of that by reading my daily newsletters and subscribing to my service. And then you'll see a huge payoff over the long term.
I'd like to get some context about that service in just a minute. But given that you've said that, and that's such an authentic thing coming from you, just give us a couple of statements. You're a pretty out there guy. You do some unusual things. Tell us about some of the background things. I know you've been a military pilot. You've traveled to strange places. You've done some rather exciting, adventurous things. Just give us a couple of minutes on that to finish.
Well, I'm your original pushing the edge of the envelope guy. I always like doing new things. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, contacts of mine in the U.S. military said, they're letting people fly their planes for $10,000 an hour. So I thought, wow, let's go. So I went over to Moscow, made the right contacts, and arranged to fly a MiG-25 fighter jet for $10,000 an hour. That involved me going to a fighter base 200 miles north of Moscow, going through a week of emergency training, ejection training, that kind of stuff. And the day came, I flew the MiG. We flew at Mach 2.5 and When I first jumped in the cockpit, all the instruments were in Russian, and they were metric. And I was doing the calculations in my head, and I said, we just went from the ground to 50,000 feet in 2 minutes. You know, are we really climbing at 25,000 feet a minute? And the pilot said, yes, that's about right. So, you know, after doing some aerobatics, and the pilot, the test pilot, who was Russia's leading test pilot at the time, figured out I was a real pilot, he let me take control and then land the plane. And as soon as we came to a halt, I said, wow, that was great. Have you got anything else? And he says, well, actually, we have this MiG-29 over here. If you want to pay us another $10,000, you can take that one up.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. The MiG-29 is the only one that can do an outside loop, which
exactly.
is almost impossible in flying.
Yeah. Well, the MiG-29, which they used to promote, is it could fly tail first.
Yeah, exactly.
And we did that. Like, and it was the only plane that's ever done
like
that.
Like a Cobra.
Right. So I said, well, what can the MiG-29 do? He says, well, the ceiling on the 25 is 60,000 feet, but the MiG-29 can go up to 80,000, maybe 90 on a good day. I go, yeah. I said, what else can it do? And he said, that's the plane that shot down Gary Powers in 1960. I said, I'm on. Let's go. Pulled out my credit card. They called it in, charged me another $10,000, and I took the MiG-29 up to 90,000 feet.
Wow.
And then I could see the curvature
of
the Earth. It was on the edge of space. I could look straight up. It was completely black. I could see stars in the middle of the day. It was an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm. John, I'd like to have you back and talk more about this, more about the economy for our listeners.
Now, you mentioned in the presentation today, and it struck me because I was going to ask the question of you during question time, that could the Americans keep getting involved with war with aging population and Medicare problems and that sort of stuff?
Absolutely not, and that's another major factor behind the changes we're seeing. At the moment, if we want to have a war with China, we have to borrow the money from China to do it. So you can't imagine that one going very far. We've never been able to afford these wars. If you recall, after Vietnam, we had an entire lost decade. The last decade we just came out of was the result of the Iraq war bleeding us dry. You know, it cost us $3 trillion. We'll be paying for it for the next 60 years.
Absolutely.
We have 50,000 men and women missing arms and legs that we have to take care of because of that war. And, you know, of course, we'll be paying off the debt for the next 30. You know, people are finally making the correction, the connection that these wars cost money.
And achieve
nothing. In the end, they just make more people hate us. And there's just no profit in that, you know, either from a business point of view or a social point of view. So I think, you know, the American public is right to pull back from this, and everyone will be the better off.
Okay, so we've got the overall perspective on the economy and look forward to talking with John Thomas. Thanks very much, John.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that was John Thomas, a world-respected economist. Thanks very much for listening. We look forward to seeing you on another one of our podcasts in the near future. This is Alan Patching. Bye for now.